Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. One of my favorite books of the year is written by a guy in Greensboro, a journalist, a business journalist named Justin Canonosa. His book, My Cousin the Saint, A Search for Faith, Family, and Miracles, is also going to be featured in North Carolina Book Watch. And so, Justin, you're joining us by telephone. Thanks so much for this book and for agreeing to talk to some of us in Chapel Hill about it. Are you there, Justin?
I'm here. I can't wait to start talking about it.
I know. Well, what you know and what I know and what the folks who are listening don't know is that we have a Chapel Hill connection. Which we'll describe in just a moment. But first of all, give us just a brief summary of what this title to your book, My Cousin the Saint, is all about.
Well, it's literal. I mean, that's the most important thing to point out, is that I really do have a relative who was canonized by Pope Benedict XVI a few years ago in 2005. And it's a relative that I am just coming to know. We didn't know about him until maybe 7 or 8 years ago. You know, my grandfather came to this country 100 years ago. It's the typical immigration story. He cut ties with all his family back there. And he had a cousin, and he was born and raised in the same little village in Calabria, who went on to great renown. He was a priest for 60 years. He was an extraordinary individual. He was remembered for a long time after his death to such a degree that Pope John Paul, during his lifetime, approved him at every step along the way for canonization. And then the actual sainting, the sainthood, was made possible by Pope Benedict. It's just an extraordinary story, and I had this wonderful opportunity to learn about him, to go back to Italy, to reconnect with these wonderful Canonosa relatives in Calabria, and then come back and do a thing that I love to do, which is write and tell stories.
You know, when I read your book, I was taken because the saint whom you talk about not only is a Canonoso, but another family name in his family is Tripodi.
Yeah, and his mother was a Tripodi.
Yeah, as soon as I saw that name, I said, I know some Tripodis and other people in Chapel Hill, where we have a famous couple, Paul and Patty Tripodi, said, golly, I wonder if there's any connection. I wonder what part of Italy they came from. And so we're going to give the answer today on this program. And Justin, I want to introduce you to Patty Tripodi and her husband, Paul Tripodi. And I want you all to see if there's anything about your cousins that you can talk about. Welcome, Paul, and welcome, Patty.
Thank you. Hi, Justin.
Hey, how are you guys? I can't see you, but I'm really glad to be on the phone with you.
Yes, yes. And one day we will get together. You
Absolutely.
Have to come up here for a good old Italian dinner.
Yeah.
Well, what is the answer to the question? Is the saint's mother, Tripodi, any kin to you guys? Or any family connection?
Well, we're trying to find that out now as my wife emails everybody that we know that we visited with in Italy at the time. My family, father, mother, are from Archi, Reggio Calabria, and we figure that that's close to, and I'm going to pronounce this, is it Choro, Justin?
Or Corio.
Corio.
Yes.
Okay. Close to Corio. It's the same area. The names and that we visited when we went to the cemetery with my cousin, there's just tons and tons of Tripodis, and we just filter through that area like a grapevine.
So. Well, same thing with the Canonostas. You outline your family, Justin, in the book, and the graveyards are populated as well. I think you were able to take your family back to 400 years or so until maybe there might have been a Spanish immigrant.
Yeah, you know, Paul, it's so interesting that you talked about that cemetery. I'm assuming that you're talking about the cemetery sort of at the top of a hill just above Corio.
Correct.
Oh, my God, it was the most moving experience to go up there and see for the first time for me, who, you know, really, I only thought that my family went back a couple generations. You know, my grandfather, my father, and me, that's all I knew. But to see the Canonosos that are entombed there, and it's all above ground, you know, nothing is in the ground. It's all these marble tombs and cement tombs above ground, was so fascinating and so moving. And I do remember seeing a lot of Tripodi names. That's so fascinating that you were there, too.
Right. Oh.
Justin, tell us a little bit more about this cousin of yours and Paul's who is now a saint.
Yeah, you know, he was born in 1879. He was one of nine children. And you know, it was very, very impoverished in southern Italy then, and in all of southern Italy, everywhere south of Rome, really. It's why we had this great wave of Italian immigration to this country. You know, they came here looking for opportunity. That family stayed behind.
The southern part of Italy was sort of like the southern part of the United States at the beginning of the last century, impoverished, and a lot of out-migration.
And largely agrarian. You know, it was farming and very little else. Gaetano Cadenosa was the name of the saint. He went into the seminary when he was 10 years old, which was not uncommon at the time. It was one of the few pathways out of poverty. And his father took him down the mountain into the city of Reggio Calabria. He became a priest in his early 20s, and he had this remarkable outreach for most of his life. He was a priest for more than 60 years, and it was all about service, D.G. He never wanted to be a Monsignor or a bishop or a cardinal or anything like that. He wanted to serve the people, and the people all had extraordinary needs. He opened schools. He opened orphanages. He founded an order of nuns. He had this mountain outreach where he would get on the back of a donkey and hike for hours and hours to go to the little hilltop villages all around southern Calabria to bring them the gospel. He had this remarkable fortitude, and he did it for such a long period of time, and that's really what led to his veneration.
Well, Paul and Patty have been back to this region now, I think, recently, and what is, you've heard Justin talk about it as it was when the saint got started as a priest. What is this part of southern Italy, right down there towards the toe of the boot? What does it look like now?
It probably is exactly the same as it's been for hundreds of years. Where you're talking about Gaetano riding the mule, we walked, except now their cars are running. And where his church was that we did not realize, in the mountain, and I'm going to pronounce it again to see if it's correctly, Pendidatello?
Pentitatilo.
Oh, Pentitatilo. Pentitatilo.
And Justin, don't they call that the five fingers?
Yes.
We went there. Our cousin took us up there.
Yeah.
And we walked all over. And obviously we were in his church, and at that time did not know it, which we want to go back. We're trying to go back this year, if not next.
Well, there's a picture of that church and a picture of that little village. It sits right hard against a hill overlooking the Ionian Sea. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It is.
But it was absolutely desolate.
It was.
There.
I think there were maybe one or two inhabited places there.
Yeah. They have a caretaker now for the village that's almost like a tourist attraction.
Uh-huh.
There's a little parking lot, et cetera. And as a matter of fact, there are two little bed and breakfast rooms open on the tip.
Oh, no kidding.
And like I said, we walked around with our cousins. And when we left, she says, they're in Pellaro, which is maybe 20, 25 minutes away. She says, I'm going to take you to a place. And they call it Cinque Terre. Cinque Terre to them is five fingers, but that means, you know, doesn't translate well in American, five earths.
Right.
But that's what they call it. And she drove and drove up there with a car, up and up and up. And now when I read the book, I'm wondering, he's on this mule traveling the ruts and grooves and walking through stones, and I mean, you are up there into the sky.
That was a part of what made him so impressive.
Right.
He was actually a priest in Pentidattilo for 17 years, and the place when he got there was so rough. And I write about this. I mean, it wasn't just that the people were poor. I mean, they were totally superstitious. They had no Christianity at all. So he had to teach them how to read before he could bring the gospel to them. It was an enormous challenge, and he did very, very well there. Did you get a chance to get inside the church?
Everything was locked.
The church was locked and closed when we were there. The caretaker, you know, wasn't there to let us in, so we did walk all. The bougainvillea were out, and that was beautiful under the mountains, but you're right. When we turned around and my cousin said, let's go, they have a little overlook. In fact, it's right outside the church.
Yeah.
It's a small piazza.
Right.
And you just turn around and look, and you could see Sicily. I mean, Sicily, you see
absolutely.
For,
and
you
on
see
a clear
forever.
Day, you see Mount Etna. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
We're going to take a quick break. We're visiting with Justin Cadenosa, who is the author of My Cousin the Saint, A Search for Faith, Family, and Miracles. And with us are the famous Paul and Patty Tripodi of great fame here in Chapel Hill, who it turns out are also probably cousins of the Saint Justice Dustin Canemoso is. So we'll continue this conversation about Chapel Hill, about North Carolina, about Southern Italy, and about resurrecting memories from the old country and
food.
And food and church.
And food and
church.
We'll
be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests from Chapel Hill are Paul and Patty Tripodi here in the studio with me, and I was able to persuade them to come visit because I said I've got a connection. The connection is with Justin Canemoso, a journalist in Greensboro, who has written a wonderful book called My Cousin the Saint, A Search for Faith, Family, and Miracles. And this book takes Justin... Justin, this is a story not only of reconnection with your family and your cousins in Italy, but also a reconnection, sort of with your growing up church. I don't want to say that you're a lapsed Catholic, but you were not the most. What is the right word?
No, DJ, you got it right, man. I'm a lapsed Catholic. There's no better way to put it.
Talk about the impact of your research about your cousin who became a saint on your own religious experience.
You know, it's a hard thing to talk about sometimes. You know, spirituality is so personal, and Catholics tend not to be very evangelical. But I've had to really talk about it in the process of talking about this book. You know, I had stepped away from the church. I was born Catholic. I was baptized and confirmed. I went to Catholic high school. But I didn't marry a Catholic, and we didn't pursue Catholicism for our family. And I'm a journalist, you know. I'm all about questions and all about skepticism. And so faith can be a difficult thing. But, you know, when you have a saint in the family and you actually go to St. Peter's Square, or the canonization ceremony, you tend to have a little doubt about your doubts. You know, you sort of look around and go, do I know more than these people? You know, do I know more than the Pope and these bishops and all these cardinals from around the world? And it really was an epiphany that I had during the canonization ceremony that I didn't know the saint very well, and I didn't know my own Catholicism, and I wanted to know more about both. And to understand Gaetano Canemoso better in America, I needed to go back to church. And I started a pilgrimage, and I started attending Mass rather regularly for the better part of 3 years. But I was absolutely a lapsed Catholic, D.G. I mean, there's just no way around that.
Well, it's hard to explain being a lapsed Catholic when you got a cousin who's a saint.
Well, you know, I didn't know about that until a few years ago.
No, but I mean, right now it is. I mean, you have to say, yeah.
Absolutely. You know, there's a little bit of responsibility that comes with that. But as I think about it, what I learned in going back to church is that it was a completely different experience than when I was a kid. And I didn't have the patience for it, I didn't have the attention span for it, and I didn't really have the heart for it.
Well, Paul and Patty, I think, have been active in the church, but nevertheless, this story of, the story of the lapsed Catholic and then as approaching the middle of your life, you sort of yearn, you're missing the culture. It's both the combination of culture and religion. I mean, do you see that, say, in the church here in Chapel Hill, Paul and Patty? Does that resonate, that part of the story resonate with you?
Yes.
Yes. Well, to some extent. When you're talking about culture and church and Italians, everything comes together in an ethnic bond. In other words, there are churches here that are diversified in 50 different ethnic groups. When we were born and raised in Steubenville, Ohio, we went to St. Anthony's, which was a school for Italian children, in St. Anthony's Church and St. Anthony's Parish, so that we were born and raised in that Catholicism.
So you're not just Catholics, you're Italian Catholics.
We're Italian Catholics with the Italian superstition that blends in with our religion, basically.
Well, when you come south, a lot of the increase in the numbers of the Catholic Church in North Carolina or in the South are a result of in-migration from people who grew up in other circumstances. But now you come south and the Catholic churches don't have the same immigrant mark as the churches might have in neighborhoods in other parts of the country. And is that something that's hard? Is it hard to give up exclusive, the, ex, exclusive Italian Catholic when you come to a church here in Chapel Hill that's, you know, that's more diverse.
No, it's not really. We are practicing Catholics and always have been. And it's amazing, in Chapel Hill, we were here the first time in the 70s. And from then until now, it's amazing how it's grown. Because when we came, we were like, you know, the minority. And now, look at St. Thomas More, how it's grown. And the church, they had to rebuild the church because it became so large.
Have 10 masses on Saturday and Sunday, and still it's crowded all the time.
Right.
Well, there's a little air of supreme confidence like that we're showing you.
But it's amazing, even being a practicing Catholic and going to church here, but when you go to Italy and attend their masses and go into their massive churches that are so gothic and beautiful, it's just amazing. It just gives you the chills.
Paul, you're mighty quiet. I'm
listening to her side of what she has just espoused, and I am going to say probably yes to all that, except that I totally miss and have a feeling that other people would miss what we had when we were young and our religion with our people, our ears tuned after Mass, coming out and hearing our language, understanding a little bit, mostly not, but becoming just all enthralled with what it was for Sunday. Sunday was Mass. Sunday was family. Sunday was food. Sunday was dress-up clothes. It was one of those things where it started at early in the morning, kept going through the afternoon. And Justin, you understand what I'm talking
about.
It just didn't stop until evening with the gentleman outside. And I know I would sit on the ground and the peaches and the wine would flow around. The conversation would be, the women were in the kitchen. This was it.
Well, Justin, reading your book, it just brings back so many memories because of your family in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And the little corner stores and how they, you know, just opened up the stores for the Italian people, brought in the ethnic part of it.
Right.
So, and it brought tears to my eyes because it was the same. I mean, in Philadelphia and in Ohio, and, you know, it was just amazing.
You know, I wanted to ask you, were your parents the ones that came over, or your grandparents?
Paul's parents came over.
See, it's so fascinating because, you know, it was my grandparents that came over. And even we had some of those traditions, and I grew up in southern New Jersey in a little island town called Wildwood. It started to get diluted, you know?
Right.
It was a little less ethnic. I mean, Sunday was still a big deal, but it didn't go on all day long. You know, in our generation now, two generations out, it's a little bit less than that. Well, you go back to Italy, you go back to Reggio Calabria, and boy, you're right back in the middle of it, where there's nothing on Sunday except church and family.
It's right.
An exquisite thing to experience.
Right.
How about you, Patty? What about your parents and grandparents?
My parents were born in America, but my grandparents came here from Naples. My grandmother was Roman.
So we think this is interesting to me because one of the aspects of the book that Justin introduced me to was to realize that the further south I had been, when you talk about southern Italy, Naples, that's as far as Americans go south. You know, that's it.
That's right.
And so you're a northern, but from the standpoint of the Canonosos and the Tripodis, you're a northern Italian if you're from Naples or from Rome.
My mother used to tease my dad
that
because daddy was from the Calabria area.
Oh,
yes. Right. Well, his parents,
right.
And she used to tease daddy, you know, oh, I'm Roman. But anyway, but they were born here.
Well, another one of the great things for me, first of all, the Tripodis are famous in Chapel Hill for food, having run a wonderful delicatessen and been in the catering business for so long. So we associate the name Tripodi with food because of you guys. But Justin, food is food, isn't it? And Italian food is something else. And Southern Italian food and the family meals that you describe in your book, that's something else that is a rare event here in the southern United States.
You know, it's just a heartier fare. I mean, I wouldn't call it fine dining. It really is the kind of food that is comfort food to the 10th degree. There are these wonderful sauces. These are these great cheeses. There are these fish dishes that are amazing. And it's not a lot of light stuff. The sauces are heavy, whether it's white sauce or red sauce. And the cooking just goes on for hours and hours and hours. And these families come together, and they will roll out on a Sunday a 5 or 6 course meal that will roll on for 3 hours.
Right.
And it's amazing. Now, as you guys are preparing food there in Chapel Hill, do you draw a distinction between sort of Southern Italian and Northern Italian cuisine?
Yes.
Oh, definitely.
Yes. We love the Southern Italian food.
You guys got my mouth watering.
I know.
Well, let me tell you, in the food difference, okay, my cousin, when we were there and Patty was cooking in the kitchen with her, we asked her about the difference, and she says, in the South, I wish I could do an Italian the way she would say, but I knew what she was talking about. The food is made with tenderness. The food is made with love. The food is made with family. As you travel north, the food becomes less tasty, a lot thinner, and not made with as much love. So it's the truth. I mean, the South is heavier. It is the olive oil is thicker and greener. The sauces are thicker. And as you go north, it will thin out. And the same as they look at themselves, they look at the people. And then as you travel north, the Southerners look at the northern people as being less lovable. Their blood, they call it zunga, is thinner. Justin, correct?
Absolutely.
And it is a difference of north-south, just like our Civil War. It's north-south. Italy is north-south.
You know, I think people that have been to Italy, you know, who aren't Italian or aren't familiar with Italian history at all, you know, lump it all in the same, Italians are Italians. And, you know, that's not any more true than saying that all Americans are Americans. When you look at our regional differences. The thing that struck me in doing the research for my book is why Southern Italians are the way they are, why they cling so close to family, why that's so important to them. And there's a long history for this, but essentially it comes down to the fact that Southern Italy, all those different provinces down there, all those city-states, were occupied by oppressing outside forces, outside countries, for hundreds and hundreds of years, whether it was the Spanish or the Greeks or the Lombards or the Goths. I mean, you name it, they were coming in and taking advantage of that very strategic location in the Mediterranean, which was southern Italy. So the native people there, they could never trust anyone. Outsiders were all invaders. Outsiders were all oppressors. And so they became very clannish, and the people that they could depend on the most, and without question, was family.
Right.
And that is genetically imprinted on Southern Italians right now, to the extent that it is family first and foremost and forever. And when you get north of Naples, it becomes less so, and demonstrably less so, even though Italy is a warm and inviting and hospitable country from north to south. But in Southern Italy, it's just different.
We're visiting with Chapel Hill, our Chapel Hill neighbors, Paul and Patty Tripodi, and also with Justin Catanosa from Greensboro, who's the author of a new book, My Cousin the Saint. We'll be talking some more about the saint and about Southern Italy after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and during the break, I interrupted Paul. I wanted to get this on. I wanted everyone to hear this.
Yeah, Justin, you were so correct in what you just said about the history and the feeling in the South.
Yeah.
And the architecture, you may go and see 3 different types of architecture on one building.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be Greek, it could be Byzantine, whoever
Absolutely.
Ran through there. But also, you can follow the food. And the food will have the steps and the fingers of the people who conquered and walked through the country intermingled, okay, with what the Southern people cook. So, I mean, we've seen what was your favorite dish going up to Palermo when we went up the mountains?
This is Paul Tripodi,
the fish dish.
Patty Tripodi, about a dish.
When he took us up to Palermo, remember?
Yeah. The fish that was baked under the rock salt?
That was one of them. And then you had, I can't remember the name of it.
Well, I'm glad you can't remember because you're making me too hungry.
Yeah, but it changes, you know, as it goes through the areas and you just love everything about it and the warmth of the South. And one more thing, the southern part of Italy is not touristy. Correct, Justin?
Not at all.
And that's it. We love it, but we know what people were missing because they have not put their foot south of Naples to just go get into, you know, what belongs in the South.
Paul and Patty and Justin, from someone who's not been south of Naples and whose curiosity is just leapt forward based on, Justin, on your book and on my conversations with Paul and Patty, give us some tips for those of us who don't have family connections down there. What is the best way to visit Italy south of Naples?
Really, the best way is by train. I mean, I think. I mean, you can brave it, and you can rent a car. You can drive in Italy, but you better be brave because it's kind of tricky to drive in Italy.
All right, so take a train from Rome.
You can take
Naples
a train
south.
From Rome. It'll take you right to Reggio Calabria, right to the toe of the boot.
All right, now tell us about...
And over to Sicily if you want.
Yeah. Tell us about Reggio.
Reggio is a big city. Reggio is a very densely populated city of about 200,000 people, and it is... In some ways, it is very beautiful on the waterfront. They've got this great redeveloped area where there's a long promenade and a sandy beach, and then there's the palm trees and the magnolias are enormous in that area. And because there was an earthquake that leveled Reggio Calabria 100 years ago, the architecture on the waterfront is fairly new, and it actually has a kind of New Orleans feel to it. The wrought iron and sort of some of the French architecture. The rest of the city, though, is very modest and is not very attractive, quite frankly, because of the construction standards are built to withstand earthquakes. But there's a lot of culture there. There's a wonderful historical museum in Reggio Calabria that has two of perhaps, the world's finest sculptures, which were these bronze statues, the Riachi bronzes, which were found in Calabria in the early 70s.
Right.
And they're 1,500 years old. They're exquisitely restored. And they're in the National Museum in Reggio Calabria. That alone is worth a trip to that city.
So that's it's worth a trip there. As Patty was mentioning, it's just a ferry ride then to the island to the south.
Right.
So to Sicily.
3 miles from Messina
Three
and
miles
across
from
to
Messina.
Sicily. But in Reggio, you have... I fatto passeggiare lungomare,
just
and that's my cousin because we were in Pelago, which is a 20-minute drive, and one of my cousins has a dealership, a Honda dealership, and that's what they would say, and we would go up in the evening, and walk that sea. Oh, the sea walk was absolutely beautiful because you can see the lights from Sicily across there. The ocean is rolling in, like you're saying, the palm trees, the park is lit up. And you get your gelato and your ice cream right there and you walk arm in arm. And that's one part of the book that really brought tears to my eyes was when your daughters were there and you turned around and everybody was walking arm in arm and you saw them hitch arm in arm.
Yeah.
That's when I saw my cousins do that, I lost it.
Oh, I know. It's such a beautiful thing. You know, Italians, there's no distance with them. You know, everything is very close. They stand close to you. They touch you on the hands. They touch you on the shoulder. And it's all about hospitality. It's all about the warmth and the generosity that flows from them very naturally. And to be a part of the passeggiata in the evening, it's a wonderful thing. You're making me want to go back right
now. It blew my mind when we did go to Paul's cousin's house and all the children came over. And when they see each other, I mean, they could have seen each other the day before or whatever, and they hug each other and kiss each other. It's amazing.
The thing that I love, in America, when men see each other, and even if they're good friends, they're not quite sure, do I shake hands or do I clap your shoulder, do I give you a hug? In Italy, the men kiss cheeks.
There's no question.
You know what you're going to do.
Right.
You're going to kiss cheeks, and it's so warm and wonderful. I love it.
Right.
I absolutely love it.
Right.
Well, continuing our little visit in Reggio, although... Your cousin, the saint, got his start in the mountains as a priest. He also had some connections to this larger town as well. And can you talk a little bit about that, Justin?
Yeah, again, he really did a wonderful job in Pendidatilo. And again, he was there for 17 years. And, at a certain point, he had reached a certain level of proficiency that was being recognized by the larger parish. There were so many needs down in Reggio Calabria as they were recovering from the earthquake. and there was a big church right in the middle of downtown called Candelora, and he was invited by the bishop to come and take over that church. And he led that church for the better part of 20 years until he retired. But it was there that he got the idea that he needed to have nuns, because it was more difficult for him to do his mountain mission work, since he wasn't living in the mountains anymore. And so he went back into the mountains and recruited these poor young women to be a part of this outreach program for him, to be sisters. And he founded this group called the Sisters of St. Veronica of the Holy Face, and they still exist today. And
well, this effort to found a new order of nuns was not without controversy, was it?
It wasn't. It was a difficult thing. You know, he didn't get papal approval right away, and it was probably one of the only times he ever went against the rules. But the need was so great that he didn't wait for the approval. He went out and deployed these nuns.
It was amazing how he pursued that.
And when Rome found out, you know, there's an office there that handles these kinds of approvals, they were very upset, and they were not pleased at all. And they actually removed him from oversight of these nuns for a couple of years, which he accepted it with great humility and embarrassment. But they sent a rather harsh nun down from Rome to essentially whip these young women into shape and into becoming better nuns. Half of them flunked out because they couldn't stand the ridicule by this Roman nun. And he was actually put back in charge of that order after a few years. And they did ultimately get their approval in the late 1950s. But it took 20 years.
Well, the point, you could sort of see both sides of the argument, in the sense that, as you point out so well in your book, the poverty of southern Italy and the isolation and the remaining superstition from hundreds of years back made it tough to bring these, what would you call them, mountain girls or hill young women, give them an education, turn their culture around all in one sort of one season. So your cousin, the saint, was perhaps a little bit more, having grown up there, tolerant, understanding than somebody from central headquarters would be.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he knew what the conditions were. He knew what the need was. And he was a little impatient with the bureaucracy. There was another really interesting point that I discovered in my research, and he didn't set out to recruit mountain women to be his nuns. He really thought he could recruit them from the sisters that were already approved and working in Reggio Calabria. But they were pretty comfortable, and they had a roof over their head, they had regular meals, and they had their outreach that was pretty close at hand. They were not interested in living in poverty and moving up into the mountains. And when he realized that, he realized that he needed to recruit poor women that were familiar with those areas. And so he did. And they became the backbone of his mission service during the latter years of his life.
We're visiting with Justin Cananoso, the author of My Cousin the Saint, and helping me as, I guess, guest host are Paul and Patty Travodi, who also have a very close connection to the story. All of us will be back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin, and Paul and Patty Tripodi, our neighbors here in Chapel Hill, have joined me to talk about a wonderful book, My Cousin the Saint, A Search for Faith, Family, and Miracles, written by Greensboro journalist Justin Cananoso. And I'm just sitting back here enjoying you all reminisce about your visits to Italy. I'm trying to worm my way in. I've got two objectives. We just got a minute or two. But you've told us, Justin, about the best way to get down to southern Italy, to the heart of southern Italy at Reggio, the town right across the straits from Sicily. All right, once you're there and you've ridden the train, one of the things that I'd like to do after reading your book and hearing Paul and Patty talk is to get up in the mountains. Now, how am I going to get up in the mountains without my mule or without transportation? What's the best thing to do?
You know, then you're going to need a car. And, I mean, there are roads everywhere. So it's not like it hasn't modernized. And they're good roads as well. And there's not a lot of traffic to get to these little villages, as you might imagine. But you can rent a car at the airport. Reggio Calabria has an airport, and you could rent a car there very inexpensively. And take these routes and just explore. It's easily done.
Head to the mountains. You go without a map. You go just serendipitously. Is that the right way to go?
You know, you can do it a couple of ways. You know, because it's so wide open there, you can actually see where you're going. I mean, you can actually say, "I'm going to head toward that hill because I can see a village in the distance." and just go in that direction. But obviously, there are lots of maps, and you can get around pretty easily that way also.
Now, Paul and Patty, I think you guys have a connection to a winery, don't you? Is that right?
Yes, the Tripodi Winery.
Yeah, in Arki, in the mountain. Well, at that time, it was in the mountains, but...
Now it's in Reggio.
It's in Reggio. The town is a little bigger, but when our family first found it, it was sitting at the foot of the mountains there, and that's where all the family brought and made the grapes. And Vin Tripodi is still there. My cousin Ignazio is still making wine, he and his brother, and we went to visit the winery, and my cousin met us out front, and naturally we hugged, we kissed, un braccio, and he turned to these stone stairs, were about 20 of them, said and pointed up on top. He says, "There's where your father was born, on top of the winery." And it was a little stone room. And I climbed the stairs, and the old wooden door naturally was shut, and I just kind of put my hand on it. But I'm thinking back, you know, in 19 whatever it was, 01, and my father was born here above the winery, and this town was just sagebrush to me, and prickly pears growing all over the place. And each step, as you walk, you don't walk in the past. You walk in the now. And you feel the now. It was just one of those things, and there was my cousin, and we were arm in arm, and took me around the winery, and it was something that, you know, you feel, you try to put in the words, and you've put them in the words, because as I read, I well up, like I'm welling up now, the tears are coming, and it was like when we went first to our cousin's home after they picked us up at the airport, and we were going to have lunch, and we were going to sit at the table, and there was the table. Well, it was fantastic, because we went to sit down, and I went to sit just on the side, and he grabbed me by the arm, and he says, "You sit here." And I said, "Well, I can sit here." "That's your chair." He says, "No." He said, "When your father visited, he sat here." And I lost it, because then he put Patty where my mother sat. That's it. I mean, we both went in that. That's where we sat, because we were visiting, but we were family. I mean,
it's an extraordinary thing.
And
one of the great things about having this book out there is I've had an opportunity to talk to lots of different groups, Italian-American groups and Catholic groups, and invariably people will say, "When I went back to Italy," and you get the story of how people get embraced when they go back, and it's just... You just want everyone to have that experience, because it's so life-affirming that family, no matter how long the ties have been broken, can be connected so quickly. They just don't forget. It's an amazing thing.
Justin, two of our dear friends, very Southern, went to Italy 3 years ago before we went, and we sent them to our relatives, to the Tripodis. They knew nothing. They couldn't even speak one word of Italian. And they met Ignazio Tripodi, found them. And they came back with tears in their eyes. They said they could not believe it, how he took them in, hugged them, and just because they were part of us.
Yeah.
So
I'm not surprised.
They just couldn't say enough.
Yeah.
Couldn't say enough. They said the southern part of Italy is the best kept secret in the world.
It is.
We've been visiting with Paul and Patty Tripodi, and with Justin Catanosa, who is the author of My Cousin the Saint. We've been visiting about the saint and how he came to be a saint. All of it is in much more explicit detail in the book. It's available at bookstores everywhere. And we haven't gotten to my secret agenda, which was I put all of you guys together in the hopes that the Tripodis would arrange to invite Justin to come.
Yes, definitely.
To the Catholic Church here, that there would be a Southern Italian dinner.
Definitely.
Cooked, and that I would be invited.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And maybe we could arrange for some more WCHL listeners to be invited as well. We'll work on that, keep up with progress. Thanks to Paul and Patty Tripodi from Chapel Hill for being a part of this program. Justin, thanks again for your book, for your appearance on North Carolina Book Watch, and you're setting aside some time during a busy season to visit with your friends in Chapel Hill. And we're looking forward to that time when the Tripodis arrange for you to come talk about your book and for them to serve up some Southern Italian food.
DG, thanks for all your support. I really appreciate it.
In the meantime, thanks to all y'all for listening, and I'll be back same time tomorrow.